this the whole time.
So, fuck.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, I just assume that the whole world not stops to like the city, right?
Government versus private sector.
Yeah. But when I started with the city, my pay and my benefits were way better than him. It's just over time it's flipped.
I didn't encourage so much. It's just kind of nice. It's like a free day out.
Yeah, I didn't either, but I was a dispatcher, so I was just
able to pick
up overtime to make up for it.
Never mind, yeah. All right. Sorry. Benefits some people, not all.
Okay. Yeah. Like now it'd be okay because we're just in a different situation than we were back then. But if I hadn't been able to pick up the overtime, it would have been rough.
The old Vice Club, and they used to have to call out all the item numbers. You remember that?
Item numbers?
We got a puppy in there.
Yeah. Did they not have barcodes? They didn't. They were really fast at it, too.
You know, there were people at the Grant Road store, I think. There were four employees on the wall who were 40-plus years old.
Holy smokes. See, that's what a 401k will get you. 40 years.
All right. Shall we get started?
Yeah.
Cassie, get away.
And is Terry with us?
Yes, Terry.
She was earlier. I don't know.
She was.
Did you check?
She was.
Both you and I.
Okay.
Oh.
There she is.
Maybe she can hear us. Hold on. We can have her up.
All right. So fiduciary training. I heard, you know, the fiduciary issues do run through all of the board's conversations, whether we're talking to the investment managers or Dana on the actuarial and the funding considerations. So it is really important that especially the new members get a fundamental understanding of these roles. And probably most importantly, that you understand that this is something that you continue to grow into the longer you're on with this. It is something that you should always be absorbing more information and getting a better understanding. And so with this topic in particular, please ask any questions that come to mind. And Craig, feel free to pitch in too if you have thoughts on what we're talking about. So one of the first things I want to go over is the difference between the city and the board. And in the legal context, it's called the settlor and the fiduciary. The settlor is the entity here, the city, that settles or creates the trust. So the city created TSRS. They're responsible, and they could shut it down. They have that power to design and terminate. The fiduciary is the person or the entity, this board, that has the obligation to oversee and manage and administer. The board does not have the authority to change it. Right? So there are going to be recommendations to make changes, but those are always going to go to mayor and council because the board doesn't have that authority unless it's specifically given a delegation. So in the fiduciary role, you're not designing a plan. You're not changing the terms, but you do have discretion. And discretion is a fundamental part of being a fiduciary. If you are just carrying out an instruction, that's called a ministerial function, and that is not a fiduciary. But when you are given the discretion to make decisions, then you are a fiduciary because you're exercising control. So investment decisions, funding policies, benefit payments. So these fiduciary functions that the board controls encompass things that you don't do here at the board because they're delegated and Dawn and the other folks in the office handle them. Okay. But fiduciary duties encompass everything where there is discretion typically. Okay. Why does it matter? Generally, a fiduciary is held to a very high standard. It is not a standard of doing your best. It is a standard that you have to approach with specialized knowledge and a specialized level of care. And so one of the quotes that I included from the report is that a fiduciary duty is one of the highest standards under the law for carrying out your obligations, and we'll get into what that means.
One way of thinking, me.
Sure.
I'm both a licensed fiduciary.
Yes, I know.
This a lot, so I'm sorry. One of the ways that I explain this to clients is that a fiduciary is, in every sense, acting for somebody else. If you're your parent's guardian because they are suffering from a neurocognitive disorder, the court has appointed you to do for them what they can't do for themselves. And so if you step away for a second and think conceptually, if I'm being charged with being responsible for somebody else, the big BFD, that's a big deal because somebody has decided that I can take over for another being. Here, we're responsible for 6,000 people, 5,000 people. We're responsible in a different way than being for our parents, but we're responsible. And that's part of why this duty is here.
Yeah, it's a good. So specifically for retirement plan fiduciaries, the standard is that you undertake your obligations, whether it's administration or investments, with a level of care. So it's with level of care, skill, and diligence that a prudent person who is educated in these matters would utilize. So there's a number of different standards there. The first is that prudent person standard. So we'll talk about the duty of being prudent. And then probably the most important part, in my view, is that it's a prudent person who is educated on these matters. So when you come into board service and you are brand new to the board or brand new to any fiduciary, the fact that you're brand new does not change this very high level of care. Okay. Part of the fiduciary duty is the duty to educate yourself, to ask questions, and to learn what is expected. So in the retirement context, we're talking about learning what does the system provide, right? What are the terms of the system? What are the legal constraints? What are the actuarial concepts that affect the funding? How do the investments work? All of those things are areas where you need to learn and ask questions and build your knowledge base. And one of the advantages of being board as opposed to an individual fiduciary is that this board has collective knowledge. And the board is acting as a group. So none of you are individually responsible for knowing it all. But I always like to say you are individually responsible for asking questions about what you don't know. Okay. And so this morning's conversation with the investment advisors or managers was very helpful from my perspective because there were really good conversations happening. And it wasn't just sitting through a scripted presentation. It was engaged. You were asking questions. There were a few things where I could have said, I don't have heard. Sometimes the lingo is very important and I tend to do it. Dana does it. We all have terms that are familiar to us that you may not know. And you should always be asking and always be, you know, absorbing that information. I like this quote from the Donovan case. A fiduciary cannot act with a good heart and an empty head. I'm going to keep going backwards, Les. One of the key pillars, if you will, in carrying out your duties is understanding what your roles are. What rules are you subject to? And in retirement plans in particular, most of the law out there that governs and tells us what fiduciary duties are come from private sector retirement plans and the federal statute, which is known as ERISA, which is the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. That's a statute that's been around since 1974 and defined fiduciary duties on a federal level. The thing that's interesting here is that TSRS and the city are not subject to ERISA because ERISA does not apply to governmental retirement plans. So it still shapes all of the rules that we talk about, but it's not literally applicable here. So, yeah.
So it helps set the legal precedent.
Yes.
Coming out of that, but it doesn't directly
Yes. So when it comes down to the nitty-gritty requirements of ERISA, the system doesn't have to meet them. But if we're ever in litigation, you can be sure the court is relying on ERISA principles. Because it's just the largest body of law for retirement plan issues. Specifically, what does apply is the city code. That's both your governing law and your actual plan document, because your code provisions make up the plan. Arizona state law obviously applies. The Arizona Constitution has specific pension-related provisions that we have to be aware of, and luckily haven't been an issue in the last several years, but we have faced issues before where this either the city or the board wanted to change benefits, and it wasn't possible because of constitutional restrictions at the time.
So you said that there isn't a plan document. It's actually in the code itself?
That's right.
Okay.
So we have a chapter in the city code that is TSRS, but it's unusual in the retirement plan world. Usually there's a plan document that gets updated from time to time. And here, if we want to update a term, we need an ordinance to go to mayor and council and change the code.
I think you referred to that before.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So it's a more difficult process than typical. And when I first came to work with the city, it's 2009, and there were some issues with service purchases and some administrative processes. And one of the things we did was update the whole chapter in the city code to add in some compliance provisions and correct some issues. And then we took that chapter and we sent it to the IRS and we said, please approve this like a plan document. So we were able to get that approval, which is great because there, you know, this, the code provisions have been around since I think 54. It's a long time. And it had never been reviewed by the IRS, where most plans in the private sector are all reviewed. So we do have that letter, you know, in the files, if there was a question about what's actually in the code. Because in that code type structure, it is much less complete than you would have in a typical plan document. There are more gaps in the code.
I mean, I would say, in my experience, that your situation is very similar to a lot of other public plans. Like, I've worked with
yes.
a lot of public plans mm-hmm. that are mm-hmm. codified, and that's what.
Mm-hmm.
What it is, there's not a plan document. It's not unusual, if that's what you're saying. You're thinking like, mm-hmm. oh my goodness, this is bad. Like, it's not unusual.
Yeah. No, that's right. It is the public plan model. But it's, if you've seen or been participating in a private sector retirement plan, it's a different one. Then in terms of the federal law that applies, it's the Internal Revenue Code, it's tax code. So the retirement plan is subject to a huge number of rules and restrictions under the tax code because of the tax benefits that accompany this type of benefit. In the private sector, there are tax benefits for both the employees and the employer. In the public sector, it's all tax benefits for the employees because we're not worried about tax deductions on the cities. So in that governmental or public sector environment, there are fewer restrictions because nobody on the employer side is taking a tax deduction. So there are some things that the IRS is a little more hands on. We also have board rules, which you may have seen some of. They are really designed to fill in the gaps in the code provisions. And we have governance policies. So that funding policy that you just updated is part of those governance policies. And I think that those are provided to you all when you enter board service, but they're available to you if you don't. And then if there is, like I mentioned, any kind of litigation, obviously ERISA would be the standard that most courts will look to.
Do we have any litigation or any issues?
We have not had litigation. We've had some serious challenges. We've had, there was a voter initiative or referendum to replace the system with a defined contribution program. And that was in a time when the financial for the city and for TSRS were far less favorable. It was a challenge because TSRS itself was significantly less funded, maybe 60% funded. And the referendum would have shut it down, which would have cut off all that new cash flow in and made it worse, actually. So there were a bunch of challenges for the board to get through that and work with the city on how to come.
But no governmental bodies have generally been moving increasingly, just as private employers have, away from defined benefit plans, which are pension plans, and work toward a defined contribution, which amounts to a 401k or profit sharing plan sector. So we're a bit of a dinosaur here, but we're still doing it this way.
We'll say a legacy, not a dinosaur.
A legacy. There you go. A legacy. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and the problem is that with a system like this, even if you wanted to, you know, move the city's funding into the 457 deferred comp plan, for example, this, it's a beast that still needs to be fed. And so even if TSRS were shut down, it still has to be funded until everybody's paid out the benefits that they have earned, which includes the 22-year-old that the city just hired. So you don't just shut these things down on a dime.
I'm familiar with the judicial pension plan in Arizona, and my best friend's a judge who retires next year because he turned 70, and he's in a plan that has a finite. It's 80% for him, 50% of the 80% for his spouse if he dies before she does. A great plan. It ran, I think, until the early aughts, and now it's a 401k. Still a generous 401k, but pension plan is gone. And it was a big attraction for a lot of people to become judges because he'd be able to retire at 70 with a hefty. You know, he makes $200,000 a year, so he's going to get on at $60,000 for the rest of his life. Anyway, sorry.
And, you know, public plans traditionally have been generous because salaries in the public sector tend to be lower. That's always been the bargain. Better benefits and lower pay. Okay, so there's the Arizona Supreme Court has stated kind of a summary of the fiduciary duty, which we'll talk about each piece of it. We've characterized a fiduciary duty as imposing the obligation of loyalty, the obligation of utmost good faith in their dealings, and requiring a high degree of care. Thus, the nature of the fiduciary relationship for agents includes a duty of loyalty, a duty of good faith, and a duty of care. Those are all legally separate duties, and sometimes you get two of them right and fail on one. They don't always go hand in hand. I figure out this mouse one of these times. Fiduciary duties arise for the board in governance of the system, investment selection, that's where we spend a lot of time and fiduciary concern, actuarial management, administration, and communications to the members. Communication is an area that is technically an obligation of the board, but that's an example of where that's delegated to the retirement office. So we have had a couple situations where the board was actually working with me to write memos to staff because something didn't go right, but that's pretty rare. In terms of the actual duties for a fiduciary, the duty of prudence is probably the most often discussed. And again, this is the duty to be a prudent fiduciary as opposed to a prudent layperson, which involves that education concept. So you must exercise care and diligence in following your governing terms, which are your city code terms, making investment selections, and importantly, hiring the providers. So hiring Callan, for example, John Craig, that hiring decision is a fiduciary decision. So even though then he's going to go out and help you carry out your fiduciary duties on all of the investments. Sure.
So, it's been a topic as an employee, just understanding. You know, I get other questions from colleagues.
You're supposed to be the expert now.
Yeah. Where's the system at? And are we even solving, you know, those things? Would it be within our fiduciary responsibility to, as the target office, report on their communication efforts and kind of show us the strategies and what they're trying to get out there. How well it's working, you know, that kind of thing. Was that within our, or is that overstepping?
No, I think that's squarely within your oversight, because what one of the things we'll talk about, but I can jump to it, is that just like hiring providers is a fiduciary function, so is overseeing the management, the day-to-day management. So if you wanted to put on the agenda communications update or understanding what the retirement office's communication strategy is, you know, how often do they hold the meetings with employees, what kind of documentation is available, all those kind of things, that's perfectly appropriate. And it might be a good time to do that because we have so many folks on the board who have been, are relatively new to the board. And unless we do something specific like that, there is quite a division between the board and the retirement office. And so I think it is helpful to hear from Dawn and Anastasia about the, you know, the day-to-days. How do they work with employees, retirees, spouses? So, yeah, I think that's one of the things to keep in mind on these fiduciary duties is that oftentimes what's required of you is that you go through a prudent process, not that you get the result correct. So when you're making a decision to hire a provider, for example, you can't pick the guy you play golf with and not interview anybody else, right? So the process is the RFP, the evaluation of options, comparison of prices and qualifications, and documenting that process, having a discussion at the board, going through your questions, interviewing. It, you may end up hiring somebody that you remove 6 months later because they're not doing the job, and that's okay if it was prudent to hire them based on the information you have. Okay? So you're required to be prudent in the selection of the person or the firm. You're required to remove them if they're not doing the job. Where that you would get into trouble in that process is if you hire someone without the due diligence, or you do all your due diligence up front, then they let you down, they fail to perform, and you don't remove them. So the duty continues. Just hiring the right provider doesn't mean that you can, and I see this a lot in the smaller plans where they hire providers, they think they're all set. The employer group, the board, steps back, goes back to their daily lives. And then they realize, oh, we haven't really been getting any investment services, and we haven't met with them or fired them in the last 3 years. That's where you're responsible for keeping up an inappropriate provider. That's why Callan works with TSRS to bring these managers in, right? So that they're actively engaging and knowing what people are doing. It is important in a system this size and a board this size to use advisors, but you can't ever blindly rely on them. Because again, you're assumed to be educated on what's required.
But I have a question.
Yes,
sir. So where we are not educated, how do we get up to par with what is before us, what we have to do now?
Mm-hmm. So active participation in your board meetings is key. You have budget available to go to seminars and training. And each year, I think, there's usually at least one opportunity where the board gets invited to seminars. And that is helpful. It's not necessarily helpful to have the whole board go to one conference. It's better if you can spread it out and absorb different types of information. But lots of times investment managers will offer programs, and there's lots of public plan forums, and all of that is appropriate. Also, at each meeting, historically, there are two or three education pieces included in the agenda. And that's been done for the last 10 plus years just to increase your knowledge base.
And I think I'll say you can ask education.
Yes.
As well, right? Like, I mean, my only contribution to this afternoon is we're going to be going through asset allocation and performance monitoring. So that is, you know, I think for some of you, it's going to be very old school, but, you know, in terms of that topic, you know, maybe it's helpful for some of the newer trustees. If we're like mm-hmm. a couple years ago, we talked about ESG,
mm-hmm.
I think. And so if there's things that you're curious about, you know, you can certainly ask your service mm-hmm. providers to provide education mm-hmm. on those, either at this meeting or their board meetings.
And I've also noticed over the last couple of years, the board meetings have been more manageable in length and volume. We've had the opportunity to cancel a couple meetings because there wasn't pressing business. So there is room in the regular schedule to build in education topics or coordination with the retirement office. There's room without, you know, unduly burdening people. In terms of prudent investments, again, this is going to focus on the process and not the results. Okay, just like the managers that came in, they're not getting the results that they want or maybe the results that you want. But, you know, from your perspective, is it prudent to have them as an investment manager, to select them and to keep them? And are they charging reasonable fees for what they are delivering? So, you want to be productively investing the assets. You want to diversify the investments so that you are minimizing the risk of large losses. Don't want to put all of the money in real estate, for example, or do some of the things that public plans have done in the past. You are not required to forecast the future or guarantee results. You're also not required to go out and get the cheapest products. You can have expensive investments if that cost is justified by what you're receiving. And hopefully we don't have expensive investments, but we want to have reasonable charges. And that's an evaluation of all of the circumstances and benchmarking and a lot of the advice that Calvin gives to you. You want to maximize your return without incurring undue or inappropriate levels of risk, and you want to document it.
And maybe I'll take just a second to talk about how we work with you on this relative to, I guess, options that are potentially available. I'm not selling this, but we work with you in what's called a non-discretionary capacity. So what that ultimately means is that you as the board have the ultimate decision on every investment decision, who to hire, who to fire. While we do act as co-fiduciaries alongside you, if I came in and said, we think you should do X, you as the board could say, no, we don't want to do that. You could make your own decisions. So what we try and do in terms of working with you is providing education, guidance, and understanding so you can ultimately make these decisions, but we do not have the authority to do that. It is out there in the market. You don't tend to see it a lot in public DB space, but you can hire consultants as what is called a discretionary capacity. So we would work with you broadly in a similar way in terms of asset allocation. But then we would have sole purview in terms of the execution of the underlying strategies. So hire, fire decisions, your role would then ultimately be us reporting to you in terms of what the results were, how things were looking from that perspective. So this for you right now is what you're seeing up here is how things work. And I just wanted to be clear kind of like how we work with you and kind of where that ultimate authority lies in terms of making decisions on the program from that perspective.
And I think, Craig, in that co-fiduciary arrangement that the board has now, I think that their burdens are a little, they're different, but I think they're also tougher because I think the board members have to know more, understand more to make those fund selection choices.
Agreed.
If you go in that fully discretionary arrangement where Callan would make all of the strategy decisions, then your responsibility is to continue to monitor Callan, but you're not getting into individual investment strategy decisions.
Yeah. Having said that, there's significant protection for all of us because we have Callan.
Right.
Because we have chosen not to take on these roles alone. And, I can tell you flat out that, I mean, this would have been a non-starter for me. I hope it's a non-starter for all of you if we didn't have. Now, that doesn't mean that if somebody asks you to be a trustee for them, if they die or at any given point in time, that you need to go out and hire an investment advisor. You know, if they have $50,000 in assets and you feel comfortable, do that. But you're dealing with close to $1 billion, and you're a decision maker, you better be sure that you have the appropriate level of advisor in place.
Yeah, I can't imagine doing it without.
No.
Yeah. So that's a good point.
Yeah.
Administration. The board, in my experience, does not get involved in a tremendous amount of administrative matters. Each month on your consent agenda, you are approving retirements. That is an administration matter. So you get those ratification reports, which means that somebody has been reviewed with the retirement office. They've elected to retire. They're eligible. Their benefit is calculated by GRS, and they're ready to go. When you approve those ratification reports, you are overseeing all that process that's done in the retirement office and with the actuary. So, again, that might be a topic that, especially for the newer board members, we want to have some education from the retirement office on what that looks like. What's that process? That's something that most of you don't see. Also, just generally, the administration includes the supervision of everything the retirement office is doing. They are technically working under a delegation. And in the governance policies, we have lists of duties that say, what does the mayor and council do? What does the board do? What does the staff do? And we probably could review those. It's been several years. But that's intended to document where the authority sits for different functions. Nobody expects the mayor and council to be reviewing investment selections. Nobody expects the board to be filling out retirement applications. So you need that delegation. The other piece on the administration side is that you have providers, outside providers, that are doing administrative work, primarily Dana's firm, GRS. They do a lot of record keeping, all of the calculations for individual retirements, and the overall valuation that Dana went with you today. So again, the selection of your actuarial firm and the monitoring are fiduciary decisions. And I have seen plans, and they have a couple right now, that never meet with their actuary and couldn't tell you how their funded status looks. They just send money. Okay, that's obviously not a good way to be running one of these programs, because at some point, if it hits the fan, that board and that employer has not done its job. And again, all of these, you know, documentation is important, all these things.
This is why, by the way, I said a little while ago, if we want to have this vote today or we want to wait till next month, I wanted to be sure that everybody had an adequate opportunity, because I don't want somebody to complain later, not necessarily a board member, but somebody looking at our policy and saying they did that in a hurry because they wanted to have lunch. Yeah. And trying to turn that in. And those are the kinds of little pieces of evidence. They don't get very far if that's all you've got. But they're the kind of stuff that has a judge saying, hey, you better look at this. So keep going.
Delegations to the system administrator. This is, you know, the retirement office, but I've covered most of this except for the fact that the second to last bullet says fiduciary responsibility can be shared, but it can't be delegated. So we delegate tasks, but ultimately mayor and council are fiduciaries, the board is fiduciary, the individual in the retirement office that is approving individual transactions all share fiduciary responsibility. So when you delegate a task, you're not getting rid of the responsibility for the underlying task or the result. You're just spreading it.
That's funny if you could speak to the second bullet. Uh-huh. How can a board be effective in having a very good relationship with the regime, them, supporting them, not going like over to their space, but ensuring that they have the resources they need to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how far down the organization chart be to be mindful of? Like, what have you seen be successful
mm-hmm.
ways that the board can kind of pop up?
Yeah.
discharges that responsibility.
I see it working the best, honestly, in terms of a, when you think of it as a chain of command. To me, the system administrator is the key linchpin for the board, because the system administrator is going to interact with the board constantly in terms of organizing your meetings, participating in your meetings, right? And then that individual is supervising the staff. I don't think it's feasible for the board to know what each person in the retirement office is doing. You just can't dedicate your whole lives to this project, right? So you need to rely on the administrator to be hiring and training staff in that office and then bringing problems to the board when necessary. And in my time with the system, I have seen that work really pretty well. I've seen problems be discovered by staff. It goes to the administrator. We figure out legally what needs to be done. We put it on the agenda. We update the board. The board asks a couple questions, but generally says, okay, you've got it under control. Just keep us updated. We have had a couple situations where, you know, maybe significant mistakes were made in terms of benefit eligibility that affected, I think we had one that affected maybe 20 or so people. The board wanted more information because they wanted to be able to answer questions about what was exactly done to fix this, how did it happen. So it depends on the situation, but the key to me is always that communication with the administrator, and are you comfortable with the job the administrator is doing? And that has been difficult in some years because the board does not hire the administrator. The city hires the administrator. And so, you know, you can have turnover in the position, right? We all know that. You may have an administrator that is not a long-term solid placement. We have had that a couple times in the past. And then you can have people that fit in that role and work great with the board. So it varies depending on who your administrator is. But I think from a board perspective, you need to be comfortable with the information you're getting from that administrator, whoever's in that. That answer your question?
Well, yeah.
No? Yeah. So I'm going to give this mouse to somebody else. I'm still going wrong.
Very good.
Okay. Duty of loyalty. Okay. So that we were talking about the duty of prudence. Separate duty, it's duty of loyalty. This stems from one of the federal requirements that applies to retirement plans, which is known as the exclusive. And that means that when you're a fiduciary to the system and you're making decisions about the system, you are doing so for the exclusive benefit of the participants and the beneficiaries. That means not the city, not the city's taxpayers, not any individual member, the system as the whole. The only official exception to this is that you can make sure that the expenses of running the system are paid. Right? Because in a perfect world, you wouldn't divert any money to pay bills. Okay? And somebody figured that out and wrote that into the law, that you can pay the bills to keep everything running. Yes.
Given the fact that, what, maybe a meeting or two ago, we discussed the city's need to have a consultant review the investments, mm-hmm. so we could divest from certain
possibilities.
Who bears that cost? Since it is not beneficial to the employees or the beneficiaries, but rather to the city in its attempt to meet its climate change mandate based on whatever assessment was done. Whose responsibility is it to pay that?
I think that initially my answer would be the city. If it turns out that a plan can be developed where we can actually expect to provide a benefit to the system, better performing investments, then perhaps it's a shared expense. But if it's, as it's stated right now, is that climate action plan is the goal of the city, it's a city project. So the plan expense question comes up a lot, and it goes back to that settler versus the fiduciary. And if the city wanted to add a new tier of benefits because it would lower the cost. That would be a city expense to pay for that design. Okay. Now, I will say in the governmental or private sector or public sector context, the rules are less stringent on where that money comes from. And in this case, you know, the lion's share of all the money is coming from the city. So, you know, there is some flexibility, but I think to your question, my starting point would be that that's a city expense. So the duty of loyalty obviously is going to go to avoiding conflicts, self-dealing, acting on behalf of the system, not the city, and generally being impartial. Conflicts in particular can be difficult for the individuals who work for the city, because by being here, you already are wearing at least two hats, city employee or city executive and board member. And the goal is that when you're doing board business, you are a board member only. And so in our conversation today, there's some important feedback that people who work for the city are able to provide. Both Angele and Terry spoke to the fact that the city can't ramp up hiring. Right? That's information that's valuable for the board to have. But it also can't influence the individual votes of those city directors.
As a board member who's representing employees, is there, what's that?
Your interest is pretty aligned. Your interest is pretty aligned. Because you are here on behalf of the employees who are the participants. Yeah. So I think that you're less likely to have the conflict situations than somebody who's in the HR director role, for example. Not to say it hasn't happened, but you know, it depends on the particular issue that we're talking about, probably. You know, you could have a situation where you have a particular group of employees who are grabbing your ear on an issue. And you have to remember that may be just a subset of the employees. You're here for all of them. Okay. Some conflicts can't be eliminated or avoided. In that situation, the board member who's under the conflict should not participate in decision. This is a two-way street because oftentimes the person experiencing a conflict does not want to recuse themselves. They want to participate in the discussions and they want to vote. And then it becomes a board issue. So if you all, let's say, Kimberly, you think that Charlton is acting under a conflict that he's not recognizing, you have an obligation as a fiduciary to bring that to the whole board. So if Charlton wasn't willing to recuse himself in that situation, the board could do it. We had that situation on this board years ago regarding one of the city directors, and that person felt very strongly and was advocating very strongly for something that would help the city, and the board had to remove that director from the conversation.
Did that I wasn't here.
No, longer ago.
It was the impetus for the board member stepping away from a non-employee board member, an outsider like me, or was it another city employee?
It was. It was the chair. So the chair was eventually forced.
Right. So one of the geniuses, I guess, mm-hmm. of this particular, you all understand each of us is here in a specific, we get here in a specific way. To be the chair, you have to be appointed by the mayor. You can't move up to that from some other way you got on the board. And part of the genius is that we've got two people who are, well, I guess either of us could be a former city employee as well.
Could be, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, typically the city manager's appointee, who is Dave, the mayor's appointee, who is me, are typically non-employees. So we don't wear two hats.
Right.
And that is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it provides a certain level of independence and an opportunity to keep an eye on potential conflicts without having any dog in the fight.
I was curious. I thought about that at some point. How that relationship is. I mean, are there any conversations, like, because of that appointment? Are there conversations about anything at all?
No.
Between you and the manager?
Between me and the mayor or the mayor?
Well, I was just curious, you know, because we have this kind of, you know, discussion all the time. And I mean, not on TSRS, just in general with the audit and kind of like component units and that, it's going to be, the TSRS, if it's a component unit, like on our IDA authority, I mean, the mayor appoints those people too, and it has to be, I mean, there's rules because, you know, it's not a clear separation. There's a conflict, potential conflict, even though there's probably not a conflict. There's an appearance of a conflict. Since we're talking about it, thought about it.
I've never come up.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious. Yeah, if you're
anybody come here with a conflict.
So if I can try to put words to it. Like somebody from the outside could say, well, you were appointed by the mayor, so you may want to do things that may favor the mayor or the city. You know what I mean? Like
that kind of thing.
Even though you're not an employee, right? And
the mayor who appointed me is an old friend. I never talked to him about this once. And then Mayor Romero reappointed me. I met her at a party and I said, thank you for appointing me. And she looked at me and said, I did that. I'd never met her before. There's not one of those simple. No.
All right. So, and it's just curiosity.
Yeah.
Because it is interesting how we all come from different spots and it brings a unique lens, which I appreciate.
And I haven't seen that kind of, I think of the chair and the manager appointments as the citizen members, right? We have citizen members, employee members, retiree members. But, you know, all these conflict rules apply to everyone. But I think that the outside viewpoint that they bring, those positions bring, is helpful because we can get a little mired in internal city issues. Okay.
And, you know, considering we just, I think this is the very first thing outside of normal procedural type things that we voted on that has impact, you know, to the city. You know, it's what we voted on today. Mm-hmm. What's the etiquette? I mean, we're all here. We have employees here. And what if 2 days from now, we hear 10 people talking about the meeting that happened today and how we voted on this?
It's public.
I mean, we need... Oh, this, it's all public.
It's all public.
I mean, like, it's public as it is right now. Like, it's public information.
We can have 20 people sit here all day and take notes and talk about it. Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
In the meantime, if you ask any questions.
No, it's all public. So we will occasionally go into an executive session, and that would be the exception. So if we go into executive session, it's typically to review a disability application, and there will be medical records discussed. Or we've done it before for legal advice on a particular plan compliance issue. Those are not public. That information is available only to the people in the room. And the chairman will read you a warning statement about keeping it confidential. We'll turn off the recording. Minutes will be kept separately. It's a whole separate procedure. But other than that, these are all public.
I just wanted to make sure that if somebody asked me a question, I never focused on.
You should be fine. And, you know, anybody can attend, right? The Teams link is public. We had a visitor. They cannot participate.
And the vote following that executive session is public.
That's correct. So we go back, we come out of the executive session, and we take action and actually motion and vote in public. And we have to be careful in those situations, like in a disability application, that we don't include any confidential information in that motion, for example. And so usually it's just a motion to approve or deny so-and-so's disability. In terms of fiduciary litigation, I'm going to just glance over this. A lot of litigation has happened in the retirement plan context the last 5-6 years. There's an explosion of litigation in the 401k context. And that's largely driven by class action lawyers who picked a new target. So if you think about the Aaron Brockovich lawyers, they turned their sights on 401k plans and they found a gold mine. Okay, so we're averaging 50, 60 new class action lawsuits in the 401k space every year. It is tremendous. It's typically not in the public sector, and it's typically specific to 401k because they follow certain patterns, and there is money to be made by following the same, filing the same case against the biggest plan you can find.
So I think all public plans are here.
I think they've all, because there have been some higher institutions that have, but they've all been under ERISA, violations of ERISA.
Yeah. That's true. So, I was thinking of the colleges, but there are
all ERISA universities.
Yeah.
And I'm not the attorney here, but our perspective, and this is not a legal opinion, it's much harder to get sued when you're not under ERISA.
Yeah. Yeah.
The, some of the rules in ERISA are a lot more stringent. Some of them are actually really bizarre in terms of what you can claim breach
on. Right. And ERISA opens the door to federal court, so which is where they want these cases to be. But generally, these 401k cases are focusing on high investment fees, so employees paying too much for their investments. And remember, those are account balance plans. They're not pooled investments like you have here. So each employee is paying fees directly from their account, so it's different. The use of conflicted investments, so putting company stock into your 401k, that's pretty likely to get you sued. Using, you know, funds in the plan inappropriately. So there are things that are very specific to 401k plans that are driving this litigation. But these cases are generating a huge volume of law about what fiduciary duties mean. Okay, so they are important. So one of the most recent cases, which is interesting because of the climate action plan, is an ESG case that has been working its way through the courts in Texas. And as we talked about, ESG is an investment strategy based on the promotion of environmental, social, and governance goals. There are federal rules under ERISA about ESG investing, and they change drastically night to day based on the administration. So we have been flip-flopping on ESG rules for 16 years now. It's been crazy. And the most recent rule was put out by the Department of Labor. They administer under ERISA in 2022. And that rule was kind of a reasonable middle-of-the-ground approach, saying that ESG factors can be considered when you're investing retirement assets if you are choosing between otherwise comparable investments. So you've got two good investment options in front of you. You've looked at all of the objective factors, and one would promote your ESG agenda, one would not. The 2022 rule says you can go with the ESG option in that case. That rule is now suspended. Department of Labor is no longer enforcing it, and they are working on a new set of rules,
which will require that you not consider the environment.
Yes. And the first Trump administration had a rule prohibiting ESG in retirement plan investments. So that's what we're headed back to. So the federal rule is really not very helpful because it's so political.
So how would that impact the city?
Yeah, well, let's talk about the case.
I mean, I guess I'll say candidly, like the fossil fuel issue is you can't make a definitive case that there's return benefit to it. The desire to divest fossil fuel and environmentally harmful companies is I hesitate to say something, I guess, in public sense, but it could be much more of a qualitative assessment than it is a quantitative assessment. So under the prior Trump administration, pecuniary factors, they basically, you had to be able to prove mathematically that you would be better off one way or another. That's extremely hard to do that when you're taking into account things like, you know, fossil fuels, climate change, a lot of that stuff.
We're probably not done. But the American Airlines case. American Airlines, obviously, enormous company, enormous retirement plans. And they got sued by a pilot on behalf of his class of participants for ESG investing that related to Exxon, so fossil fuel related. And American Airlines used BlackRock as their investment manager. And really in the role that Callan serves for the board. So they were an investment strategist, right?
So they're the target date offering that they have.
Oh, okay.
So they're like American Century or Champlain, they're one of the managers, but they manage the target date suite in American Airlines 401k plan. They got sued because Larry Fink has been very vocal about promoting and pushing climate change initiatives through proxy voting on a lot of those companies. So the way that BlackRock implements their target date fund, it's all index funds. So they hold enormous shit. They're probably, I think they might actually be the biggest index provider in the world now. So they own a lot. To Mark's question earlier, how much of a company do they own? They own a lot of companies. So through their proxy voting initiatives, the suit claimed that they were promoting ESG factors. So they didn't actually have an ESG investment in the fund.
That's not what I meant. But they exercised their proxy votes to swing the Exxon
that BlackRock
board election.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they replaced three directors on the Exxon board, according to the court, by virtue of their proxy. And that caused an immediate drop in the Exxon stock price. The American Airlines class said we were damaged because our retirement plan investments dropped because of that. And this suit followed. The thing that's interesting from my perspective is the court went through the steps that American Airlines took to select BlackRock, monitor BlackRock, do their prudent investment process, and said they met their fiduciary duties, then they might have actually exceeded industry standards. Did all that right. But they breached their duty of loyalty by allowing BlackRock to advance their ESG agenda in the proxy votes.
But they awarded them nothing.
But they enjoined them. So there's no money damages. So that's
great.
So everybody's saying,
oh, boy, a lot of legal fees.
Just flat legal
fees. Millions of legal fees.
They've got a bunch of hoops they've got to jump through.
They do. So the injunction is no joke. I mean, they are barred from doing anything related to an ESG agenda. They're, you know, so the injunction has some restrictions that nobody wants to run a huge plan under. But the thing that's interesting, and this is a Texas case. I mean, we've all heard about Texas cases being a little bit out there in the last few years. And who knows where this will go. But right now, the court drew a very clear distinction between these two different fiduciary duties. And they said definitively that ESG investing in a retirement plan portfolio where there were not the pecuniary measures was a violation.
It strikes me the price of Exxon stock went down. Was the pilot who sued, was he the retired pilot or a potential beneficiary in the future?
Well,
was there any measurable damage? Price goes up, it goes down?
They did acknowledge that the price went back up. So the claim is based on the temporary dip. And in that kind of plan, if you took your withdrawal during the dip, there's damage, theoretically.
Yeah, but you can't necessarily ascribe the damage to this.
That's it. Well,
how many
the
did
court
this?
They did.
The court did.
Yeah, the court did it.
Judges can do what judges want.
Yeah. And that
brings us back to this.
Yes.
Possibility with the city. And all the more reason the city needs to pay for what this study or assessment, whatever, which is supported. So it kind of absolves the board of any responsibility in this school.
No.
Okay. Tell me.
So. I like your payment ideas, but the board under the city code is charged with investing these assets. So if there comes a mandate to divest from fossil fuel investments or change these investments because of fossil fuels, the board is directly involved in that conversation.
Can the board say, no, we will not base on our, because it's my priority?
Yes, I believe so.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
So the city could do what all it wants. Without interference from the board. Mm-hmm. But in the implementation of that's where the board is.
Yeah. And so I did, just so you know, I did talk to the city attorney's office about it. I said, I'm worried about it. These assets are uniquely positioned, have separate legal requirements. We need to be careful. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I have passed that on. And, I also do think that it's beneficial for the board to have a voice in the process, as opposed to just receiving a report at the end of the process and then being in a position to say no.
How would the board lend its voice to that decision? We've gone to three investment vendors, and each of them have said, oh, no, we're not. And none of us said, but they simplified it to a point where I'm going, yes, that's exactly what we want. So we are there now. We haven't gotten entered into any agreements. What would the board like to see us do, or what information would the board require from us before an agreement is reached with the vendor?
I would like that vendor to consult with Callan on issues specific to TSRS.
Okay.
And that gives us the board a voice for these concerns.
Mm-hmm. Because to me, at the end of the day, after speaking to the individual, it's like nothing's going to come. Because they know what they cannot.
Okay. So. Well, that's helpful from my perspective.
Yeah. I have a question. What about the things that we already did? Like Pete was on the phone saying that we divested the border walls or stuff like that.
So, I mean, I can clarify that one specifically. It's on the books.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody can define it.
Yeah, I mean,
so it comes up every time you all try and contract with managers, like that this is there. They're like, that's great. People are like, we're happy to comply with that.
Who is it?
Yeah. It's not like who's working on the border wall, who has worked on the border wall. It is not easily available public information that anybody can put their hands on.
Right.
So it's being complied with. It's on the books. We recognize that it's discussed during contract negotiations. But to my knowledge, there is not a single name on there that has been on the list.
Right.
And my sense from what I've read about the border wall was there were very few public companies that had any in the border wall, except perhaps they were, you know, somebody bought product from them. That's
right, but the point is you can't trace it.
So yeah,
the city doesn't have a list, so there's not actually a way to enforce it.
Yeah,
in any capacity. You know, I think for other things, I think it's Israel, one of them. Things like that are a little bit easier, and they get coded. You know, for their similar account managers, they get coded for that.
And in Israel, I feel a little bit better about, because I also don't think it has a material impact where fossil fuels could have a material impact on the strategy. But the avoiding companies that boycott Israel is a state law requirement. We have, you know, so the system is subject to state law. It's not a city policy. You know, there are certain, it's kind of like, you know, we have to follow the federal tax code. We have to follow state law. So there are legal things that give the board and the city protection if they're a state law.
what is that kind of requirement?
That, I mean, not invest in a company that boycotts the trip.
Oh.
It's in every bond financial document also. Yeah. It is.
Yeah.
30 countries apart right now?
Well, companies, though.
300. That's just straight up. Not true.
Very interesting.
All right.
Okay, I'm going to speed this up because we still want to get to Craig's.
My flight got delayed over an hour, so
okay.
I'm good.
The Constitution protections that I mentioned, the Arizona Constitution does protect public pensions in particular and gives them elevated rights. So when we have had conversations in the past at the board or with the city about changing benefits, the general answer is that we can change benefits for new employees who don't work here yet. But there are protected rights for everyone who is hired by the city. And so that's why you see the different tiers in the system. They always apply to people hired after a date. And the protections don't flow through to every provision in the code, but it's the fundamental benefit structure. So the contribution rates, the formula for the pension, those are protected. And that was a huge case for public safety if you made benefit bond.
As individual board members, are we protected to explore our fiduciary duty of discussion, but responsible for actual votes taken, that those votes were within the fiduciary?
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, so part of being the prudent fiduciary is the full and robust discussion.
Okay.
So yes, you can have the discussion. It's the decision and the process implemented that are going to be officially measured, but it shouldn't curtail your conversation. Okay. Prohibited transactions. This is something that's relatively rare in my experience in the public plans, but there are tax code requirements that basically prohibit and impose tax penalties for self-dealing. And so this could be self-dealing with the city, with the board members, with one of your providers. But you don't, you know, you have to be careful that, again, the assets of the system are used exclusively for funding the benefit and paying the reasonable expenses. If you got into a situation where expenses were paid that were not reasonable, you know, but there were some type of kickback or subsidy arrangements, those could turn into prohibited transactions. The other one that we have to be aware of is a prohibited transaction involving the city itself. And that typically arises in retirement context through an impermissible use of system money. So we are very careful to keep the system assets segregated and separated in a trust fund, and that is to avoid the prohibited transaction. Because if the city were to use money that belongs to the system, that's one of these prohibited uses.
Not meant to be pooled with the prior city.
Correct.
Okay, so
it's
believed
on the
vote
that we just did. Working on the city, somebody takes the lead to like get it on the docket for moving, or do they have to move it?
Oh, for the rates? That's usually the administrator. Yeah, so the administrator works with the manager's office to get those recommendations into the budget. So, yes. Answered that like I knew the answer. Okay, and then I'm just going to wrap up with, we had a provider come to retreat a few years ago, and he did a really good fiduciary presentation in very plain English, probably less legally, and I know less legalese than I just used. And so I like to remind everybody of the points that he made. For a fiduciary, just showing up is not enough. We want you to rely on your experts, but it's not a magic wand. So you can't turn off that internal voice just because an expert said you could do it. No attorney can prevent a fiduciary from being sued. You do not need to do everything yourself, but you may have to fix somebody else's mess. Rules are rules, even when the results are uncomfortable. We've had a couple of those. Focus on the process, not the results, and document.
Any questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Chris. You're up. Okay, you're welcome. Now, watch you kind of scroll up and purple page. I'm not going to tell you which way it goes.
Okay, so.
I don't know. Sorry, hold on.
Hopefully, you all, I think you all have hard copies of my stuff in front of you. Because I wanted to give you flexibility on what happened in November, I did bring preliminary third quarter results. Because we are so early in the quarter, our peer groups have not closed yet. So there's no peer groups in here. These are investment manager reported results right now, but it's going to be directionally very, very consistent with what you see, or hopefully very consistent with what you see with the final reports. But I wanted to go through maybe very quickly on this, see if you all had any questions. You know, I know we had both American Century and Champlain in to talk today, but if you just flip to the one page, Lucy, do you mind learning? If not, Mark, it's in this one. So page one, just looking at overall asset allocation, you're still over $1 billion, which is awesome. You are still relatively underweight to real estate. At the last meeting, Pete had mentioned that capital is being called for both Harrison Street as well as as well as principal.
Do you need to blow it up?
I was going to. Not only let me right click away from the box. So. That's fine. So we will see that underweight continue to pull down. As maybe as a quick reminder, because we don't know the exact timing of that money coming from both JP Morgan funds, we only committed at this stage $30 million each to the two managers. Their total allocation will
these video recordings to boards and commissions.
I apologize. This thing is very sensitive.
Is it open?
Okay,
you?
Sorry.
You good?
Thank you.
Yes, sorry about that.
No, you're good. I don't know exactly where my train of thought was there, but no, we're good. So maybe let's take a look at performance. I'm going to go let's take a look at the net of fee numbers. So if you're in the hard copy, I think it says 5 on the bottom of the page. So certainly both Champlain and American Century have been a challenge. You know, you see here Champlain much more so. You can see here over the 5-year period, they're down by about 6% on their benchmark. You know, we discussed this a little bit during lunch. I'll say it now. Their performance is very, very explainable by what has happened in the market. The fact that we have seen a lot of meme stocks, low-quality names rally very significantly is very clearly very counter to their style in terms of what they invest in. You know, all that said, it's tough. I wish I had a full 930 report so you could see peer group rankings, because over time they don't look quite as bad. You see, we've seen a lot of other active managers look very, very poor relative as well due to very, very similar factors. You know, I made the comment this morning during American Century's presentation that the fact that we've seen more negative earnings, non-earners, not revenue generators in what the mid and small cap benchmarks has been a challenge, because as those names have actually done very well in the environment that we've seen, you don't tend to see a lot of that being utilized by active managers. So I would say Formarin, not necessarily ready to pull the plug. Do recognize the numbers are bad. Like, there is no other way to say it. Like, they're not good. But we would be more concerned if they been changing teams, changing people, changing process and approach, and numbers were still bad. So all that said, it is obviously something we are keeping an eye on. You guys heard from them today. So, back to this fiduciary discussion, does the board feel differently about that assessment and giving them more time?
I personally feel like they have a very cohesive narrative and strategy of what they're targeting and sense of where they're going to put value. And there will be, as the market cycles, there will be opportunity to back and potentially outperform others who maybe are less rigorous there. Other strategy of people. And I think for that reason, it may be worth keeping them to extend it for a while while diligently watching them to see, should, like, let's say the market moderates and a lot of those, poor companies, poorly formed companies that are doing very well, turn out not to do well. If they're still not shining in that kind of environment, that is, we would need to really assess them.
That would be concerning to us as well.
Yeah. But I almost see it as, like, I see it as a form of diversification, to have someone who's very focused on fundamentals, someone who's looking at it, especially in the equities.
Probably,
which
I asked them. But I understand that what is happening in the market is very normal, but are they adjusting or should they adjust their strategies some to accommodate what is happening? And of course they said they invest in the winner. But I don't know.
So our answer to that would be if they were changing their approach based on the market, that would actually be concerning for us, because you hire them partially for their approach. I think one of the things you saw in some of their charts is that they do tend to protect pretty well when markets go down and sideways, which investors like. One of the things over the course of my career I've seen is, you're good. It's fine when people are outperforming when markets are up, but when markets are going down or they're not doing well and you're underperforming, it's even worse. People hate them more than anything else. And so the dynamic.
But I'm not asking for that, for an entire change in strategy.
Yeah.
That's not what I'm asking. But like they said, they have this fixed focus market. factors. What are, can they at least move into something else? Of course, they said, well, that is not sufficient given where we have trapped.
So I think what you heard them say was if they think that something has fundamentally changed with a name or an industry that they had previously discarded because it doesn't meet the criteria that they're interested in investing in, that they're absolutely willing to take a look at it, which was the example he gave for Windows specifically there. And so I think that's the kind of thing you want to hear is like, no, we're not so dogmatic that even if things change, we're absolutely not going to do this. And so I guess what I took away from that was if we do think something has changed and now meets the criteria for quality evaluation that we're looking for, we're open, and we'll be,
let me pose this question because what I'm hearing is generally diversification. Probably makes sense to have this style, at least as a part of our portfolio. They're pretty combined at less than 10%.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other managers following their style who have somehow figured out how to follow that plan and do significantly better? I'm guessing not.
I mean, specifically what they do, no.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're a quality-focused manager, you have not done well at all.
And if somehow there's a quality-based manager who's done marginally better than they got lucky with five stocks and this one didn't, and we're not going to go chase that.
There are managers that have done relatively better, but they all have different approaches. They're picking different names. So, yes, there are managers that have better results.
And next year, these people have better results than they do.
And that'll actually bring me to, American Century really quickly. If you look at their 3 and 5 year numbers, which are the ones on the far right, they look really pretty. When you look at the last year, when their style came back in favor, as we've seen rates come down, we've seen small cap growth outside the U.S. do significantly better. And look at that result. They're up, I think, what is that, 4.5%?
Yeah.
Over the last year. And so there is some belief in reversion to the mean. The question is what is the patience in terms of the relative underperformance? We have actually seen a lot of clients end up going passive in the space. I know we had that discussion a little bit earlier. But when you do see so many challenges from an active management perspective, it's really ultimately your all's appetite in terms of riding the waves of that.
And when you say passive, you mean just going through
the biggest index. Yep. Yeah.
So let me mention real estate because we had the JP Morgan people 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
We finally decided you could start from the got a few months ago. And now we're moving on. That doesn't mean we decided real estate was bad. We just figured out we could find better managers with a better portfolio. And it's not that they were bad people or bad managers. They just had the wrong properties.
Yeah,
so in a sector where you can't turn on the dime or even a dollar.
So, I mean, the ultimate decision as well on JP Morgan was it wasn't just relative performance. It was the fact that there ended up being multiple team changes.
Yep.
They had some leadership turnover and things like that as well. So there were a multitude of factors that ultimately resulted in that. You're not seeing other factors at play with either Champlain or American Century.
I asked about these some for a reason. I'm general counsel for a local company that's a very large ESOP, so I was curious. I was impressed by the fact that they have 16 employee owners. That's a company design that suggests we're committed to our people, committed to performance long term. To me is a good thing.
Yeah.
They probably have very little turmoil for sharing the wealth with the people. Doesn't mean that they're doing it the right way. They could have a terrible strategy and still have a bunch of owners, but it's a good policy. It's a good policy from my perspective.
I will say their built-in structure of having skin in the game of their own investments alongside their clients too, right? For them to succeed, aligned interests, right? I think that is a beneficial structure.
They clearly will never be a company that has 10 or 15% of our pool. They're sitting where they ought to be. And that said, if in a year or two they still haven't turned the corner, we have to decide that that's not the right strategy.
So I think real quickly.
I was just going to say, and this may go to your point, I personally like the fundamentalist view, but there's many that think that the fundamentalist view, the fundamental view, I should say, has, like ever since 2007 or 2008, it just has produced as much, and the market may have changed around it where, moved to the past no longer intent. Will it return? Like, will the market regain sanity in that sense? Maybe it should, but will it? And is that a concern that Callan has, or what's your view?
Callan still firmly believes in active management that over time you can add value. I mean, I think it was an interesting conversation earlier. What was it, 60% of flows or 60% of assets are now invested in index funds? I think he said, so the question is the results that we've seen, the fact that people aren't, following fundamentals, is that just because there is so much money in, passive management that it outweighs some of the fundamentals? I mean, if you think prior to 2022, we were in, 15-year market coming out of the great financial crisis. So everything was pretty much going up. We did see some inflection in 22, a little bit in 23 where fundamentals did play a role. We do think moving forward there will still continue to be information inefficiencies, and we do think there is value there. I mean, candidly, like whether or not we're right, it's hard to say. I mean, I made the comment earlier about emerging markets. I was a huge fan of emerging markets. Like when I first started investing when I was 18, my whole IRA was in emerging market equity. It's gotten just destroyed. The fundamental story makes a lot of sense, but it is absolutely has not worked at all. And so we still think it's going to work. We still think there's reasons why it's going to work, because at the end of the day, good companies should do better over time. The question then becomes is what is over time? We don't have an answer to that. And honestly, it's the same thing with, some of the ESG discussions. If you are a better company, if you are a better governance, and you think people are important and you take care of them, like do those things accrue and benefit you over time? Maybe, probably should they? Yeah, they should. Does that work in the short or intermediate term? Maybe not. And I think that's some of the challenge you see with active management, especially when they're very, very momentum and policy-driven markets.
Back to the index funds. To me, it's an interesting conundrum, because for any individual investor, the investor with their 401k, they're encouraged, we're all encouraged, put your money in an index fund and forget about it. Let the market take care of you. Don't be a stock picker. Don't be trying to overthink the system. Collectively, it becomes a real problem. But individually, it makes sense.
Yeah.
And that's a real conundrum.
Yeah. I don't have an answer for that. So.
Because clearly a meaningful chunk of that 60% is in 401ks and individual houses. A lot of us.
Yeah, and I kind of think of these two funds almost as maybe a little bit of a defense position. Since they're value oriented. So it seems like now, with everyone worried about maybe the market being high and correcting, it seems like a more time to get rid of them.
Well, I mean, American Century is growth.
I see Champlain and
Champlain.
Champlain is a defensive situation. American Century is interesting because it's a fundamental approach, an international approach, right? It's almost like two opposites trying to merge.
Yeah, I mean, I would say American Century actually complements, and most of the board wasn't here when we did this, but we did a structure review of the non-U.S. equity piece because you're benchmarked to the all country world XUS IMI, which includes small cap equity. The inclusion of American Century actually gets the overall structure and characteristics very close to that benchmark. Obviously, your performance doesn't look like the benchmark, which is not the intent, but we want the characteristics to roughly look like the benchmark because your other two managers are a little bit more core, a little bit more value-oriented, higher in the market cap spectrum. So you're actually getting something relatively unique from that. And from a standalone basis, it looks tough. But I think when you look at, you know, your top line non-US equity numbers, they're pretty compelling relative to, you know, to how you're measuring the track record that looks really bad over 5 years. That has Aberdeen. And Aberdeen was terminated 23, I think, because very challenged performance. It was unexplainable, basically.
And they came in and basically said, we're just going to stick with what we're doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And without the polish that we got today.
Yeah. And so like, so that's in the track record. But I think if you look over 3 years, you know what, you're a percent and a half over the benchmark. Like, so the non-US equity piece, I think, is overall doing what it has been intended to do. And I know I've got the education piece. T. Rowe Price, we've talked about it before. They're another quality manager. That's really been the AI story. So, you know, again, very explainable. I do like to look at the bottom line here, looking at the numbers. So you can see here, from a net of fee basis, quarter to date, return just under 5%, slightly lagging that policy index. 12% over 1 year, 13.6 over 3 years, and then 8.3 over five. Just keep in mind, your assumed rate of return is 6.75, 6.75. So, you know, over that 5 year period, very slightly below the benchmark. But from an actuarial return perspective, how it's help funded status, it's been in the portfolio has been in a good spot for you. Like I said, what I will do when we get actual final numbers, I'll send all of that to Lisa with a note and some comments. But I wanted to go through this at least a little bit quickly just on the off chance so you guys could cover it, ask any questions. And if you have nothing else for November, you don't need to hold a November meeting just to have us present on this. So.
Okay.
Oh. I'm
seeing what you're
doing. Okay.
You aren't sure.
Yeah.
You what?
Oh,
okay.
I'm down.
Do you want me to go to the other one?
Yep.
Okay, sorry. I
want to bring that up.
I actually.
Okay, so while she's pulling this up, the education piece is in the presentation with the white cover page. The. I think we've probably shrink this. Perfect. The idea behind this was to allow you all to ask questions, just go through kind of the basic concepts of asset allocation. So we have included asset liability modeling in here, as well as kind of walk through some of the basic performance stuff that we sometimes talk about. It's intended to be, I would say, educational. Feel free to talk and ask questions. I don't need this to be me just dictating the entire time on that. So, and I would say it's really more high level. We do have some of your specific results modeling in here. I'll say they're in here because they are yours. I'm not intending to use this as an avenue to go through and discuss the results at all. More just to provide you with your actual results and the types of things that we talk about and look at. So, you know, you see here at the top, asset allocation is the number one contributor to results. So, you know, you might hear me say or refer to others say that asset allocation drives, you know, 90%+ of your return. And so what that means is the returns that we were just looking at, the vast majority of that, and this is at the total fund level, are influenced by the asset classes that you're investing in. So equity, fixed income, and then further by large cap, small cap, non-US, and the like. Manager selection, other factors do add value, but the overarching return that you get is really dictated by the split between equity, fixed income, and other asset classes. And so it plays a very important role in terms of what your decisions are. We spend a lot of time on the managers, but at the end of the day, asset allocation is highly influential in terms of your endings. So slide 5, modern portfolio theory. This is the overarching philosophy that really governs asset allocation. And this is to get efficient portfolios. And you might be saying, well, what is an efficient portfolio? Efficient portfolio is effectively the portfolio where you get the highest return for the lowest level of risk. You really need 3 factors for this: expected returns, standard deviations, and then correlations. And so correlations, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in a second, but that's really how asset classes work in relationship to each other. Harry Markowitz, when he put out this concept and this research, won a Nobel Prize for it. But this is really the underpinnings of theory and model. I did. I looked this up. I'm completely blanking on it right now. I don't remember offhand anymore. So this, oops, I keep forgetting my computer's attached to risk aversion. So you know, with modern portfolio theory, one of the concepts is that investors are risk averse. What that really means to you all is that you want to be compensated for taking volatility. So the more volatile, the more chance you potentially have of loss, the more you want to be compensated for this. 1952.
Okay.
So what this line shows is really on bottom axis, the expected return or the expected risk, expected return on the vertical axis. So really what this says is, again, the more risk you take, the more you want to be returned for it. So see something like private equity, emerging market equity on the far right, very high risk, but you expect very high returns. On the very far left, you look at cash. Cash has very little volatility, but you also don't expect to make a huge amount of money from cash. And so, again, the trade-off is you expect to be compensated for any risk that you are taking. When you look at modern portfolio theory, when you run all the math, you combine correlations, standard deviations, and expected returns, run it across a multitude of scenarios, things are roughly normally distributed. So that effectively means that, you know, 2/3 of the time, the return that you're expecting will fall within one standard deviation. 95% of results will fall within 2 standard deviations.
So are these models for the Tellehen discussion?
It depends on whose model you're running.
Okay.
I think you asked me that when we showed our model earlier this year, and I don't remember what the answer was. So again, the reason that that's important is in terms of the confidence that you can have, you know, for what, where your returns will be for the model. We want to move on to correlations. Again, like I said, this is how asset classes move in relation to one another. So something with a correlation of one means it's a perfect correlation. A correlation of zero means it has no correlation, and a negative, like something negative. So like you see private equity and U.S. fixed income has a negative 0.04. It's almost zero. But a negative correlation would effectively mean they move in opposite directions. The reason that this is important is, as we can see on the next page, is when you have different investments with different volatility, different expected returns, and you combine them into a whole, the whole can be just as effective as the individual pieces. Things looked at in isolation might look very, very risky, very, very chancy. You put them into a portfolio like we were just talking about with American Century, and it really gets you to where you want to go over the long term. On page 9 here, which is up on the screen, you know, you can see here those two individual investments, very volatile returns. When you combine them into a singular portfolio, you see the highs and the lows aren't nearly as much. And so the ride to get there is a lot smoother. And the reason that this is applicability for you all is, and you know, I think Tarleton made this comment earlier, losing money is really difficult. When you're losing money, you then have to compound from a lower point. It takes longer to get back to your highs. It has fall-on implications to contributions and things like that. And so the smoother you can make the ride, the easier your all's job is as fiduciaries, and the easier it is, and ultimately to get to full funded status. So, you know, asset allocation is one thing. So that was theory behind it, very, very quick theory behind it. I'm going to walk through kind of how this actually works in practice. Yeah, senior lien is kind of touchy. So if we want to actually, I'm going to flip down to page 12 and start here. So these were our capital market assumptions from this past year. I think most of you sitting here were not actually in the room when we went through the asset allocation modeling at the beginning of this year. But what we do is we develop 10-year projections every single year. Our projections tend not to change a huge amount year over year. From that, but these are the inputs that then go into the asset allocation model. And so we use those 10-year geometric returns because those are really the smoothed out returns that we expect over time. We don't expect that return in any given year necessarily, but we expect it effectively to average out to that. We'll use U.S. equity to basically 7.35 over that 10-year period. You can see that other shaded column is standard deviation. So again, that's the volatility of the investment. So you see equities very high. When you look down in the middle of the page at things like short duration, core fixed income, significantly lower, less volatile. You do see that we have relatively high volatility for some of the private market stuff. Core real estate, you see up there is 14. Infrastructure at 15, you see private equity at 27. You know, that's because at the end of the day, their underlying characteristics are still relatively equity-like. So even though your valuation is muted quarter over quarter, they do have volatility over longer time periods. And then certainly inflation plays a very key role. Our inflation assumption has been roughly 2.5% for the last number of years. But return and risk are two of the biggest components that go into the asset allocation model. Before we start taking a look at results, I do want to point out, and I think the slide on 13 is interesting, allocations vary widely by plan. They vary widely by plan type. And so when you're comparing returns, asset allocation, you know, like I said, plays a very heavy role in terms of what returns look like. So there's no necessarily right or wrong. Yeah, I mean, you look here at the different sectors. Corporate defined benefit plans, a lot more fixed income because it's much easier to hedge their liabilities than what you see. And then because of the payout component for endowments, they can actually be significantly more aggressive, especially in alternatives and the lockup of their portfolios because they have payout rates, not specific obligations. So you see different things across.
Oh, the average, the equities are on the bottom and the alternatives are on the top. Is that right?
Yep. Yep. Equities are on the bottom. Fixed income is in the middle and alternatives are on top. I mean, you've certainly seen public plans, just defined benefit plans in general, add more private markets. But because you all have promised obligations, a lot of pension plans are mature plans that have negative cash flow. They have to be a lot more cognizant of the liquidity factor than you see in some of the other spaces.
So for public plans, we're actually...
You guys have very little alternatives, just the core real estate and infrastructure.
Yeah.
Well,
we actually
have a page in our report that looks at your allocation relative to other public plans. I actually have it in here as it relates to performance monitoring. So.
Does that include the SPRS?
I like where you're
going. So. I think this is an interesting chart. We picked 7% because it's relatively close to your assumed rate of return. But what you see here is back in 1995, you could have had a purely fixed income portfolio and achieved 7%. As we've seen rates come down over like a ton over time, you certainly see how the portfolio mix has changed. So now, 2025, to get that same 7% return, you can see what the resultant allocation looks like. 37% fixed income, the rest really in return-seeking assets. You can also see what it did to the risk. So volatility, so standard deviation went, from 5 to 11. And so what that does is it expands the range, pretty significantly expanded the range of returns that you could expect to see, over most periods. So I guess questions?
I guess one question I have is, compared to most plans, do we have more equity investment or less, or we don't?
So I'm going to give you a very consultant answer on that. It says, I'll say it depends on how you decide you want to define equity. Yeah. From a public equity standpoint, you have relatively more public equity than other plans. That's because you don't have any private equity. So a lot of public plans do have allocations to private equity. And so when you're looking at an overall total equity allocation, it's probably pretty close, but you know, all of your equity is public.
Is there a reason why we ended up with mostly public equity? Like what were the main drivers? Is that just like a result of the process for how we chose funds? And there was private and public, and we chose public? Was it past leadership?
So, I mean, I've only been around for a couple of years here. In the discussions we've had and we've run the modeling, it's not been something I just wanted to look at to introduce to the allocation. I don't know historically
it's just a lower why it was not. I don't know that there's any consistent theme. It's just a lower level of confidence.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, I think to maybe one of the questions earlier, like if that is something the board wants to explore in greater detail, we can certainly do some education around that, if there is a desire. But one of the things with asset allocation over years, we ask, are there other asset classes you want us to model? Do you want us to look at things? Yeah. And when the answer is overwhelmingly no, or we talk through some of the stuff and say, nah, we're still not interested, then we don't model and look at it.
It's kind of like not a lot of alternatives. It's just, I feel like the board just hasn't been that expansive in the classes that they've been interested in.
Yeah, well, and I would also say, you know, one of the reasons that people have gone into private equity, or I guess I'd say a couple of reasons, but I mean, one is certainly the volatility mitigation. You know, when you're not getting marks on private assets 3-6 months afterwards, it does minimize the volatility, but also the return enhancement. I mean, the return expectations for locking up your money in private equity are significantly higher. You guys have a pretty low discount rate. Yeah, we were looking at the returns, net of fees over 5 years. What was the number? 83? What do you need? I mean, any plan would be super happy with an 8.3% return. You know, yeah, like, would it, I mean, if we get 9, I guess, that's great. It helps on the contribution front, but it also does come with downside risk. It also comes with that liquidity risk. So when you start having the discussion, like for you guys going into private equity, what is the impetus? Yes, there are absolutely more private companies now than maybe there had been. So it does open up an opportunity set. But from when you start thinking about it, dropping into the portfolio, like where do you all see it fitting? Where does that make sense? And so I think that's where discussion starts to fall apart as well, is the portfolio has been doing really well. It's been performing well in excess of your assumed rate of return. So the typical reasons that people add private equity, like you haven't really seen it here. So this is the asset only modeling that we did this year for you. I think the couple of things to point out are, you know, one, when we do the modeling, just looking at assets, you can see their projected risk and return in that chart on the right-hand side. We look at the probability of outperforming both your assumption as well as returning more than zero. And in almost all the scenarios over 1, 5, and 10 years, we expect you to return more than zero. That almost a 74% chance returning better than zero even in 1 year, which is really good. Roughly 50% chance of outperforming that assumed rate of return over these different periods. And I will point out that the range of outcomes shrinks over time. And that's really just because the month-to-month volatility gets smoothed out. So the expectation of hitting a specific number over time shrinks. So like I said, these were your actual results. This is the type, you know, this is taking the correlations, expected returns, standard deviations, throwing it into the model and pumping it out. So when we run asset only, this is what you look at. There are more slides that we show, but I thought this was the most pertinent for how you'd see this. So I'm going to stop here real quickly, see if there are any questions. Yes, you can ask a question, or are you deciding if you want to wait?
Someone's looking at me to ask a question. I guess one thing.
You don't have to.
You know, hedge funds are in the alternative space, correct?
Yep.
I don't know much about what's on the market in terms of hedge funds, but one area that I'm personally interested in is actually hedging. I know a lot of hedge funds don't necessarily hedge.
Sure.
But like, are there good solutions on the market today that would hedge equity risk in an affordable way? You know, like self-serve, some sophistication or I'm just thinking, you know, we're very equity sensitive, which has been really great as equities have gone up. But if equities stop going up or crash, you know, hedge funds are the type that have the catalyst to be able to help offset that in kind of a direct index performance way. But I don't know if that's common or available or if there's a discussion around that, it is a conversation of interest.
So I'll say it really depends on the plan. You don't actually see a lot of hedge fund implementation because most hedge funds are not designed to do what you're describing.
They're not. They're really not.
So, yeah. So if you're talking about actually buying and utilizing derivatives to protect against some of that, yes, there are plans that do it. It is definitely the minority. It tends to be pretty expensive. Timing is always a question mark. Like, how long do you maintain those hedges when you put them on?
Right.
Like, what are the – yeah. And so you don't tend to see that nearly as much for most firms.
And we have close to $700 billion of equity. If we're going to hedge against a catastrophe, we gotta spend a whole lot of money on the hedge. And that takes down your return as long as equities are doing well. It's a pretty expensive proposition given the dollars we're talking about.
In general, I mean, and honestly, where you tend to see it a lot more often is when people have very big internal investment staffs. Maybe they run some of their strategies and things like that. You tend to see it a little bit more when they're doing it internally, and they have a lot more direct control over that. I don't see
it outsourced. And to some degree, we hedge by diversification is hedging, correct?
Yeah. Well, and I think Tarleton did. I mean, diversification is some hedging, but still, I think we looked at this when we actually ran the asset allocation. And I don't remember. I want to say I think 90% of your portfolio risk comes from your exposure to equity. Like, it is easily the majority. I mean, it's almost all of it. And so I think, you know, we had this discussion in 22 when everything went down. You guys had a rough 2022 because of how the portfolio is set up. The fact that, you know, was it 83% is in public markets, right? Like, as long as you can ride the waves, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does make some of the downs a little bit more frustrating. But that's actually where some of like the private equity, private credit conversations start to come in, is bringing maybe a little bit of that there, because that does help reduce that quarter to quarter, that very time period sensitive volatility.
So, but how much of that is actually real versus the fact they don't report their losses?
That's
the market to market. Unless I'm skeptical about private equity.
So, I mean, I can tell you, you know, what happened in 22, you know, obviously equities and fixed income went down really substantially for the year. Private equity held up. Then in 23, you started to see private equity marks come down. You didn't see them mark down nearly as much as what you saw on the public equity side. So, even, yes, the marks are delayed, but it does tend to mute it a little bit. Because in most environments, the behavior or the issue that transpired to crater public markets has tended to wash through and solved by then. So you do see, we did see write downs. We saw pretty significant write downs, but they were not as big as what you saw on the public market side from that. Yeah. And to the point in terms of the diversification, you know, comments and the correlations, like, it made the whole portfolio ride smooth, just because if, you know, I'm making up a number, 40% of your assets go down instead of 50%, that 10% is meaningful. And then if that next year that 40% is going up, that 10% goes down, the whole journey to get to the end point is just a little bit smoother. I will say plans ran into, though, to serious asset allocation problems. Because you can't really effectively rebalance out of most of these asset classes. And so they had to also suffer through pretty extended periods where their asset allocations were relatively out of whack. But you all don't have massive liquidity needs, but for those plans that have liquidity needs as well, it just exacerbated that, because you can still only take that out.
So one thing related to the space, I think, is a portfolio of we hope that it works. We have, we're looking at past performance and correlations.
Yeah.
But each crash is a little bit different, and there can be crash correlations that you expect.
Agreed.
And so when that happens, you know, the safety you thought you had, you may or may not have. The thing with hedging, if it's done successfully, and it can be very expensive, it can be a drag, is if you can reduce the downside potential, you know, mm-hmm. If you can really help compensate and not fall so bad, especially if you're over-allocated or have a strong position in something that could be sensitive to that, you know, that even if you're not hedging for all of it, like if you can soften it, you're getting liquidity right when you need it, as opposed to, you know, spending a little bit extra when you have extra and not seeing it bear fruit. It's, at the end of the day, it's a risk either way, but it's, I think it's, depending on how fragile you see the market, it may be prudent to explore. And if we're not doing any alternatives at the moment, I'd be interested to see what companies, they are proper in that space. But that said, you know, you don't need to fix what's not broken. And, you know, things are going well, that's good. But we have to make sure we don't get too comfortable.
It's expensive to do hedging and swap agreements and stuff. And in my past, the casinos, we had heavy debt. And we did all these swap agreements causing crash. You know, it was like you could borrow for practically nothing at that time. And we had to pay tons of money out every month for this swap agreement. You know, so it's just, yeah, you thought it was a good thing, you know, because you know, hedging risk, but it was, like, very painful. I think it was at that housing crash.
All right. You've got more, Craig?
Yeah.
Okay, press on.
All right. So, up until now, we've been talking about just the assets, but keep in mind, you have a liability on the other side. Your liability is a promised obligation. And so looking at the assets always in isolation doesn't necessarily make sense, because we want to make sure that they can work together. And I'll, when we look at some of why, you know, we'll show later, but you know, certainly the key metrics, get your investment policy, your benefits policy, and then your funding policy. Okay, we've talked about the funding policy today. You guys here have a very good funding policy, which has been very helpful. We obviously, we've got the investment policy. And you know, those are really, at least for this plan, the two key metrics. So what's the goal of the asset liability study? It's to get you to a long-term asset allocation that really helps to balance out that equation you see there. Because you know, you've got benefit payments and expenses, that really has to equal investment returns and contributions over time to have dollar for dollar. And so there are definitely trade-offs when you are making asset allocation decisions in terms of what that impacts. Concerned about cost over time? Are you concerned about funded status? Are you concerned about both? And again, those have trade-offs that are worth considering. So we did a full asset liability study last year. We typically do those every roughly 5 years. So we run asset-only studies every year. But we do asset liability every couple of years. So you can see here when we do this, we take all of the liability stuff from your actuary. Yes, we have actuaries on staff, but you guys hired GRS to run those numbers. So we take their numbers and do not monkey with them. We use, obviously, our capital market assumptions, our modeling tools to create allocations and run what the impact looks like for you. We run this on what is called a stochastic approach. So we actually run 2,000 iterations And in each of those iterations, they change certain factors so you get a range of expected outcomes. The asset liability report is much more detailed than what you see here. All I did was take the summary of the study and what it would mean if you moved to different results and outcomes, or I'm sorry, different result and asset allocations, what that would mean for really funded status and contributions. So you see there you've got, you know, the target mix, which currently has 25% fixed income. We looked at the impact because obviously interest rates moved up significantly. What's the impact if you move more money to fixed income, right? So you see there the impact on those asset-only metrics. Return goes down, but also volatility goes down. We saw an improvement in the Sharpe ratio across all of them. What does it mean for funded status at the median? You can see there, because you have lower expected returns, funded status actually went down very, very slightly under these scenarios. What does it mean for the worst case? And so this goes to some of the comments that Tarleton had earlier. What happens when stuff just doesn't work and it is really bad? What you see there, there's actually an improvement in funded ratio if the world goes really poorly. That intuitively makes a ton of sense. You have more fixed income, your outcome would be better because fixed income does tend to, fixed income tends to protect better when markets are going down. Then you look at the impact on contributions. You can see at the median cases, contributions went up under all scenarios where you you've increased fixed income. Again, it's intuitive. You have lower returns. You need more contributions to get to funded status. Looking at that worst case scenario, there's some pretty significant savings in the worst case event. And so, again, like I said, there's trade-offs for making these decisions. So this is ultimately what we looked at the end of last year in terms of looking at the asset allocation as a way for you all, you know, at least to show you what the different trade-offs were for making different asset allocation decisions. Because we didn't look at any additional asset classes, this really focused on the level of fixed income in terms of scenarios. But if we were looking at different asset classes, we can model it so you can see, you know, different impact from these. And so this is really the result output, but it's also why we think that looking at liabilities next to the assets is important, because you think about things from an asset-only perspective. And it's like, well, maybe we should be doing this. Maybe we should be doing this. But then the question is, well, what does that mean for your actual, for your ultimate objectives, right? Like, what does that mean for your funded status in 10 years? You know, we heard Dana here today saying 2033 is the projection for full funding right now. 2034, now you're right. And so it's important to understand that when you are making decisions on the asset side, they have potential impact on the funded status and contribution side. And so,
yeah. So this table is basically, like, if you take the 40, you've taken 15% from equities and real estates, did a scenario where you added 15, that same 15 to correct, right?
Yep.
And so you said, okay, over 10 years, we're modeling that we're going to be losing as opposed to the original case, right?
Yeah. So next to the base case, your return would have been 7% instead of 7.3%. Your standard deviation. So this is the delta versus the target.
Okay.
Yeah. So this was like a 60-page presentation. It had all the charts broken out, but it was really hard to see what the impact was on everything individually. And so that's why we put this page together to say, hey, these are the differences relative to targets if you were to do this. So yeah. So then the standard deviation would go down from 11.2 to 9.6, and you'd see a modest improvement in Sharpe ratio. So, again, like on the contribution side, increasing fixed income because you have lower expected returns, it came with an increased expectation of the median for contributions. But in the worst case scenarios, especially on those ultimate net cost numbers, there were some pretty meaningful savings if things did not go well. And, but again, like these are the types of things we like to talk about because, you know, you all as fiduciaries sitting around the table, it's what does this mean if, you know, if we do this, right? And certainly worst case is what we like to protect against because that doesn't do anybody any favors.
So, the reason why I bring up the Gaussian normal piece of this is that, we shouldn't make all our policy around, you know, the catastrophic thing that could happen, but maybe never will. But if things get really bad, or the probability that something is like in the 97th percent isn't that different from 99%. Or, you know what I mean? Like, sure. Once you get into that telos, like, you can be, it's not, like, probabilistically, it's not very different to be twice as bad as, you know, really bad if you're already past a certain threshold. So the normal distribution doesn't tend to capture the tells.
The telltales.
The telltales.
Right. The spark.
And so, like, you know, what's often listed as a worst case at normal distribution is kind of optimistic of that really bad situation. Understanding that that's still a really bad situation, that's not really like, right?
So, I mean, to that specifically, when we do this again, I can clarify how we run this model. In my understanding, I don't believe that our, because of the stochastic modeling nature, I don't think it comes out as, I don't know if it comes out as.
It's very, Gaussian is very much used in the industry. It's the normal distribution, so it's like standard deviation type geometry. So it's basically the typical statistical curve that you can see. Yes, so that curve. But like natural systems will have more logarithmic or other types of shapes where the tell extends far beyond the page. So rather than having kind of a beautiful symmetric shape, in reality, you almost never end up in that tell space. But if you do, you end up pretty far down. And the Gaussian usually underestimates the tell potential.
We're behind schedule.
Yeah,
we can do this in another session too. It's not like this is something we have to finish today necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, it's your all's call. I mean, we've got performance monitor stuff. You want to go through that or push it?
Let's you've got more stuff after this. Right?
Well,
How much time do you need for the rest of the meeting after Craig is done?
Probably just a few minutes, but I need to have 5 minutes with you. So.
And how much more time do you think you got to go through the
rest? I could be done 5 to 10.
In
5 to 10 minutes.
Okay, finish up.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
So alongside your fiduciary duty, your performance monitoring is one of the most important ones. Certainly performance measurement, that's what we do. Every quarter for you, we do send a monthly report as well. We do a time-weighted return methodology using custodial information as the key record on that. And then the evaluation is really comparing it against different relevant metrics and putting it into context. Wanted to go through benchmarks and peer groups very quickly. So benchmarks are really the industry standard way to evaluate managers. You have what's called a blended benchmark for your total portfolio, so it's made up of multiple underlying benchmarks. But these are supposed to be, style-specific and relevant for you. They tend to be market cap-weighted. And then like we heard this morning to that last bullet, managers should be able to talk to you about how their strategy relates to the bench, to how they are using to monitor themselves. Peer groups are, and I guess I would also say benchmarks are knowable in advance, and they are generally invested. Peer groups are what they sound like. They are peer managers. So, like, we're talking about, you know, Champlain, like, their peer group is other mid-cap equity managers out there. They might have different approaches, different, you know, styles and implementation, but they fit into that mid-cap bucket. So it's another way to look at how your manager or your fund is doing relative to others. The challenges with peer groups is that they change over time. They're not investable, and they do generally suffer from pretty significant survivorship bias. So
that means they go out of business.
Yep, they go to business. Okay. Sometimes they get removed from the peer group. They
I'll get, make sure I give that term then.
Yep. So asset allocation, you know, we talked about this. You all have an investment policy that dictates a specific target allocation. This is something you have ranges as well that the asset classes can move between. So you have policy guidelines that determine this. So this is something that we look at. In general, I think it's relatively self-explanatory. You can see, you know, the different asset classes, the weight, the target weight, and then the difference. We have the difference of both percentages and dollars. So a lot of this stuff is fiduciary check the box. These are the process things that we're talking about. So it sounds silly when we go over it, but they're the process things that you ultimately get, you know, potentially judged. So this was what I talked about earlier. I'd say this is your asset allocation relative to peers. The way that this public fund peer group is structured is it's a little bit more specific to your asset classes. We do have a broader one that I can show you at a different time that has kind of everything, but it shows you where you relate to peers in this sector. You know, so as a whole, the question was, you all are slightly overweight to equities relative to what you see because you've got so much more public equity than what you tend to see on the other side. But it's just another way to compare your fund to others. It also does help put performance into context when we do look at your performance relative to others. Because, for an example, like when we've had very good equity markets, you all tend to look very good relative to peers. When we have not had good equity markets, you tend to look worse. And so if you're saying, like, well, why are we ranked X, this can help. This is another metric to be able to help explain that. I know that when I go through performance, I don't do attribution a whole lot, but we do have attribution in our report. And so what this does is it helps you to better understand what the return drivers are for the portfolio. I'll tell you, I picked a year because the numbers look really good here, depending on which period you look at. They don't always look at, you know, necessarily quite as good. But what you see there is the effective actual weight. So it's more or less the average weight over the period, the target weight, is the target weight. The actual return you see here is the return that you all saw in your portfolio. So the returns that we show you. The target return is the return you would have seen if it was the benchmark. The manager effect, more or less, it's a calculation, but it more or less gauges the actual return relative to the target return. If you did good or not. So, like, obviously, the biggest bogey you see there is that negative 31 basis points. The small mid-cap equity has been a challenge. When we look at those two managers, they have both underperformed over time. The asset allocation effect is whether or not you are over or underweight to your allocation and how it relatively performed. So when you see there at the top that 4 basis points for large cap equity. You had an effective weight of 30%, Target weight was 27%. Large cap equity did very, very well over the last year, so that was a benefit. There is a, then you see the total return relative. That's really the accumulation. It's not always just simple plus and minus. There's actually a mathematical calc behind that. But roughly seven basis points that have been added over the 1 year period from the overweight as well as the managers in large cap equity. You can see that all, you know, you see totals down there at the bottom. And so this can be an interesting way to look at performance. We have this over multiple periods in our full report. So if you are ever wondering what are the drivers, we do have these for multiple periods in each of our quarterly reports. Total fund evaluation, this is, you know, looking at the fund relative to target as well as the peer group. So those bands obviously are the peer group. The lower your number, the better. That means you are performing better. And again, you all have had pretty good relative peer performance. One of those drivers has been we've been in a very, very long period where equities have done very well. And you have seen those returns. You generally see your fund above that triangle, which is your policy index. Certainly there are some periods that are not as good as others. But this is the way to look at it. Certainly those big gray charts are that the distribution that you see down there then numerically below. But this allows you to look at the total fund from multiple perspectives.
So the policy target would be
the green
6.75%.
No, so it's the blended benchmark, which is right now it's 27% S&P 500, 25% Bloomberg DAG.
Oh, 24% allocation.
Yeah, it's your target allocation to the underlying benchmarks. So this is another way to look at the total fund and the evaluation. This is similar to one of the charts that we looked at earlier. I can't remember which manager that was. But on the bottom, you see volatility. On vertical axis, you see returns. So ideally that, what is it, the upper left-hand quadrant is where you'd want to be. Lower risk, higher returns. You don't see a lot of the dots there. You tend to see the dots in the lower risk, lower return area, or in the higher risk, higher return area. You see that's where your fund is sitting, kind of in a little bit more volatility, higher return than the index. But this goes back to the asset allocation and efficient frontier being the highest level of risk for a given level of the lowest level of risk for the highest level of return. And so we decided to just look at this from a total fund perspective. We have very, very similar charts and evaluation for the individual managers, the different asset class segments. We do go into some more detail on the asset class from the individual manager stuff. Taking a look at sector allocations, regional holdings, things like that. I was not going to go over that because the performance evaluation, look is roughly the same for all of us. So I know this is very quick. I'm certainly happy to take any questions.
Thank you very, very much. We can revisit these issues in a future time as well.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's a lot for somebody who hasn't seen it before to take in first time now.
Yeah, no, they're good. And I would encourage you all, if you have questions when we are going through the performance report, do feel free to ask when we are when we are doing
it. And it does seem more intuitive once you're looking at the walkthroughs. Okay. All right, we're going to take about 5 minutes, and then we will finish up. Thank you again.
Real quick.
Let's come over here.
Yeah.
We do use fuzzy the asset liability uses to be different, but the guy I'm asking the capital markets team.
Not always.
Okay. I'll have to get back to you.
So what time was your flight?
So 4:25.
Oh, okay.
But it got delayed till 5:40.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
Yeah, but it could take you ages to get to the airport from here if you leave at rush hour. I mean, I know the freeway's right there, but but the snowbirds are back.
That's what it is.
It's true.
Yeah, and it's only going to get worse as we get closer to Christmas.
That's why you try to do the construction jobs during the summer.
Now, who wants to be in construction in the summer?
They do it at 4 a.m.
Yeah.
That's how it was when we got our new roof.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They woke us up at 4 o'clock in the morning for a week.
I bet your neighbors loved you.
Didn't seem to bother the neighbors.
Okay.
No, but we were under it, so.
What moment don't bother you?
Don't mind my face. It's moving a little bit.
It's just a long,
Did you message me about it? I don't know if I've approved.
Yeah. Sure.
I can get in there right now and check.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna have to do his punch outs for today.
That's fine. I'm not going to get approved before Monday morning anyway, but I just want to make sure, like, if you need to leave early tomorrow, leave early, don't overtime. Right?
Looks like you already approved it.
Okay.
So, we're good.
I don't know about you guys, but I'd rather go home early on a Friday than have overtime anyway.
I mean, I will say that's actually one of the nice things about doing this. I'm staying instead. Because the 4:25 is still the last flight, so if you happen to have an issue on a Friday, it's like there's something mentally that's so much worse about getting home late or being just late on a Friday. It's like it's Thursday. I'm in Denver. I would much rather get home, but the fact my flight got delayed. Even if I was like geared to in fact, I landed at 8:30 instead of 7.
Yeah.
Like it's not, but if it's Friday, I'm there's just something.
There's something
mentally about it. If you're coming up on the weekend, it is.
There's something about it.
In-laws that live near Golden.
Hour
drive from the airport longer.
Yeah, right?
Golden is so
well, you know, it's funny when we travel.
Yeah, they're in Genesee.
I always have my cup with me.
Yeah, I mean, I gotta say,
when we
moved out there from New York.
I always have my cup with me.
2017.
Because here you have to help.
Had a 6-month-old and a 2-year-old.
And they don't understand.
No. Yeah, 6 months, 3.5 years. My wife was like, "We're buying it.
Sit in your chair.
We don't know Denver. Like, let's rent, figure out where we want to be.
Yeah.
No, we're buying it. So we bought. And, I mean, I like our neighborhood. It's close to
the best.
It's also now that I know what I like and I like Denver, I would much rather be out in Golden or Evergreen.
Yeah.
Okay, we're gonna wrap up in the next few minutes.
Yeah.
When you leave, please take food. That's why it's there.
Yeah, there's a bunch.
Yeah.
Eat steak and sour.
whatever it takes. Oh, it's
I don't,
better than McDonald's.
I didn't, at first glance, I didn't know.
Just taking out so.
Okay.
Thank you.
So.
Oh, okay.
So let's take it away.
Frank,
you're leaving?
I'm in Phoenix, so I just dropped.
I was going to.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah,
oh. Oh.
He's got to get to the airport before rush hour.
Yeah. Oh, go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Say thanks again.
Thank you.
Yeah. Safe travels. Yeah. Okay. All right.
No, when the investment managers had their material limits.
All right. So we just wanted to quickly announce that TSRS did receive the FY 2024 ACFR award. So thank you, Pete Buxton.
What
did you say?
20 years in a row?
Yeah,
yeah. 20
thing. Oh, it's, I don't know what the total is.
Yeah, but, yeah. We're going to make a, well, no, I'm kidding. I was going to say, we'll make a decision. We're not putting this on the agenda unless we don't win you.
Okay.
What happens, Carl?
We're going to win it.
You don't want to hear that your staff is doing well?
No worries.
Pardon me?
You don't want to hear that your staff is doing a good job?
No, I want to hear that. Okay. The next item on the agenda was review of TSRS organizational structure, role of board staff and consultants. We're going to table that because it's late in the day, and it's been a long day. We appreciate all the engagement and involvement. But we will table that and discuss it, except to observe that having listened to Cassie's excellent presentation about the fiduciary role, we don't have control over who staffs our entity because the city takes care of that. So it's a little bit of a quirk. If anybody ever feels, at least for the next year while I'm the board chair, if anybody ever feels like there's an issue, please contact me because we don't get to say if there's a fiduciary problem. If there's a problem, well, you know, we didn't have any role. But we get to say it, but it may not. So if anybody's feeling like Lisa's not doing her job or somebody else isn't, don't feel like, oh, gee, you can't do anything about it because it's the city. Contact me. I have zero reason to expect I will hear from anybody, but I mean, that's true. Okay. The last item is we have a current board term review. We have one board member. We have an error with respect to an appointment versus election process. We're going to be working this out, and you'll hear about it at our next meeting. But it's a process. It's an unfortunate error. We're sorry, but we will get it straightened out and move forward. Okay? These things happen. Four, five. We have a forum. Look, who was? Oh, Terry.
Terry. Yeah, but Terry's not on.
Terry's not.
Yeah. Okay. We still have a quorum.
Yes.
So do we have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Is there a second?
I second.
Thank you. I don't think there's any need for discussion. Would you call the vote?
All right.
Because I was told we have to do that.
Aye. All right. Terry's out. Steve.
Aye.
Charlton's out. Kimberly? John? And Mark.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for your good participation and a long day.
Thank you.
It's been really nice to have
all these
long days.
It is a good thing.
Guys, get to renounce pressures, everything.
Little did you know.
Yeah.
Kathy? Sorry. Since it sounding like a possibility that November might be a council, but I don't know if Lisa knows what the process is for ratifying requirements without meeting.
Yeah, right next to
I don't know. Because we have some items we said for the next meeting. So
well, I don't know. I just know that sometimes reviews get canceled. And we do have a process for getting the requirements ratified because they do have to be ratified. Okay. I just don't know what a process is.
Let me just say,
look, because I'm
cool. Thank you. And that way I can send a very nice printer email for future
reference. So, you guys are supposed to
take care of your feet.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
But you're still.
We'll figure it out.
Well, I'd rather have at least technically everything.
Oh, yeah.
Than not for
Thanks for having me.